Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Russia's Putin calling for statehood for eastern Ukraine and Iraqi forces free a besieged town and its people. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Russian President Vladimir Putin is calling for immediate talks on statehood with eastern Ukraine. The president speaking on statewide television today. The president says statehood is needed to protect the interests of the people in the region. Meantime, the European Union today agreed to call for a new list of sanctions against Russia if, in fact, it doesn't back off in eastern Ukraine. Iraqi officials say their forces are now in the militant besieged town of Amerli, bringing relief to thousands of people suffering for over 2 months with dwindling food, water, and medical supplies. The U.S. today provided air cover for government troops as well as dropping aid to the town's residents. Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott says his country is now joining the effort to supply weapons to Kurdish forces.
We've agreed to join this airlift at the request of the Obama administration in the United States and with the permission of the Iraqi government.
Pentagon Press Secretary Rear Admiral John Kirby said humanitarian drops were also made by France, Britain and Australia. A boat carrying at least 100 African migrants capsized off the Libyan coast. The Libyan Coast Guard said today it found the damaged rubber boat about 15 kilometers offshore, 50 kilometers east of Tripoli. The French news agency reports about 15 bodies found, including two women and children. And at least 11 people are dead after Somali forces repelled an attack on a Mogadishu prison for al-Shabaab militants. The militant group is claiming responsibility. Gunmen exploded a car outside the facility, then stormed the main prison gate. This is VOA News. Israel says it has shot down a drone that entered Israeli-controlled airspace over the Golan Heights from neighboring Syria. Israel says it believes the drone belongs to the Syrian military fighting rebels and accidentally strayed into Israel's airspace. The United Nations says all Filipino peacekeepers besieged by Syrian rebels in the Golan Heights last week are now safe, but 44 Fijian peacekeepers are still missing. Philippine Military Chief General Gregorio Catapang said 40 of his peacekeepers engaged in a seven-hour firefight Saturday with Syrian insurgents, but overnight made what he called the greatest escape.
The armed forces of the Philippines and the United Nations will not compromise the safety and security of our troops while in their pursuit of their duties.
The Fijian peacekeepers remain in the custody of Syrian insurgents. Pakistani police today attacked reporters and photographers covering crackdowns on anti-government protesters in Islamabad. A minister in the government, Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, condemned the attacks, as have news organizations around the world. At least three protesters are dead and more than 300 people wounded since yesterday. IS Ghul reports from Islamabad.
For more than 2 weeks, thousands of protesters have been camping out in front of the parliament in Islamabad, demanding that Prime Minister Sharif step down. The protesters are part of two separate mass rallies organized by opposition leader Imran Khan and a firebrand cleric Tahirul Qadri. The Prime Minister rejects calls for his ouster as unconstitutional. His attempts to find a negotiated end to the political crisis have not succeeded. The stalemate provoked rally leaders late Saturday to call for the demonstration to move toward the nearby official residence of the Prime Minister, who was away in his home city of Lahore at the time. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
China's state legislative body says it will tightly control nomination of candidates for a landmark election in Hong Kong in 2017. The National People's Congress Standing Committee decided today that candidates to become Hong Kong's next chief executive must receive a majority vote from a broadly representative nominating committee in order to run in the 2007 election. The ruling makes it highly unlikely that any opposition candidates will get on the ballot. The decision will likely anger pro-democracy activists in the former British colony who threaten civil disobedience if China prohibits direct election of candidates and calls Beijing's pre-screening of candidates fake democracy, rendering any vote meaningless. All of China's chief executives have been chosen by a small election committee stacked with pro-Beijing loyalists. The first openly gay player selected in the U.S. National Football League draft is out for the time being. Michael Sam, chosen by the St. Louis Rams, was released in final roster cuts ahead of the season. All NFL teams must reach a 53-man limit this weekend before season opens next weekend. I'm Marty Johnson.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening. It's Sunday, August 31st. Welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Mpuga.
You're dealing with one entity that's well organized, as we all know, well financed, and I guess the other word is well placed.
Calls for the United Nations to intervene in Libya as chaos continues.
It is absolutely essential to have an agreement in the north of Mali. If we want stability, a return of development, to remove the sense of isolation and marginalization that many in the north feel, even those who did not take arms in rebellion.
Rebel groups from northern Mali agree to end hostilities ahead of negotiations with the Malian government.
Levels of violence in townships and suburbs and rural areas, particularly against women and including against lesbian women, they are terrible.
And a look at attempts by the South African government to counter a poaching epidemic. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The French government is pressing for the United Nations to intervene in anarchist-struck Libya, arguing that without exceptional support, the North African country could fall into chaos and spread terrorism across the region. Some regional powers are already covertly intervening. Jamie Detmar has more for VOA News.
The first mysterious airstrikes came on August the 18th and were followed 4 days later by another sortie. Not that they had much effect. Pro-Islamist militias still seized Tripoli's badly damaged international airport. The airport grab from a pro-government militia from the western mountain town of Zintan served to underline the strength of a coalition of Islamist militias, but the airstrikes were what captured media attention. Libya has no truly functioning air force, so who launched them? US officials tell VOA the warplanes came from the United Arab Emirates and used bases in neighbouring Egypt. The officials insist the Obama administration did not approve the raids, but was aware they were likely to be launched. American officials, who declined to be identified, also say Algeria is among other countries that are playing a secret role in the fighting that has convulsed Libya. Neighbour states are terrified by Libya's collapse into all-out militia warfare between coalitions vying for control and the presence of Al-Qaeda-connected jihadists. Diplomats from Egypt, Chad, Tunisia, Algeria and Sudan recently met in Cairo to discuss how to halt the violence in Libya. They've argued that further escalation will require full-scale foreign intervention. From Tobruk, where the Libyan government has moved because Tripoli is too dangerous, philanthropist Hassan Tatanaki, an advisor to the Libyan government, argues the anarchy gripping Libya should not be seen as a local civil war, but as part of a post-Arab Spring struggle for regional mastery between secularists and Islamists. He contends Islamists and jihadists are part of the same movement.
You're dealing with one entity that's well organized, as we all know, well financed, and I guess the other word is well placed.
Hassan Tatanaki is critical of the Western powers' strategy since the NATO-backed ouster of Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi 3 years ago. He says the West was too ready to deal with Libya's Islamists, but now he is fearful of any intervention by Western forces, saying even ordinary Libyans will see that as a colonial move.
I'm totally against what the parliament or the government is preaching now, the intervention of the UN in Libya. That is a disaster.
Libyan Prime Minister Abdullah Althini takes a different tack and is pleading for UN intervention. As the fighting worsens, several thousand Libyans have fled their homes and many middle-class families are fleeing the country. Libyan-American Halima Halaj left with her husband and two children. She says the fighting and disruption is worse now than during the uprising against Gaddafi.
It's a lot worse, a lot worse. I mean, to the point where we just could not stay there anymore. We just, 7 o'clock in the morning, we just left. It's really difficult. And everything is closed. I mean, no one's working. The ministries are all closed, banks are all closed, supermarkets, everything. It's very difficult there right now.
The UN Security Council has called for a ceasefire, but there are no signs that the militias are ready to stop fighting. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Washington.
The United Nations is reporting huge improvements in Zimbabwe's prenatal, newborn and maternal health care over the past 5 years. However, the UN Children's Agency says the survey indicates that Zimbabwe must continue working to improve health standards. Shabastian Mhofa reports for VOA from Harare.
According to research findings released Friday, Zimbabwe's infant and maternal mortality rates have declined by 20 and 36% respectively since 2009. The number of pregnant women who received prenatal care increased from 57 to 70%, while mothers accessing care after giving birth had soared from 27 to 78%. The research was funded by the European Union and conducted by the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, and the government of Zimbabwe. Much of Zimbabwe's progress is due to assistance from a multinational fund dedicated to improving health care for mothers, newborns and young children. Despite these encouraging results, UNICEF's chief representative in Zimbabwe, Reza Hossain, says it is too early to say all is well with early child care in the southern African country.
We should keep in mind that, yes, we have won battles here and there. We have bent the curve that was going up like this in maternal mortality. But we have not really won the war as yet. These gains cannot be sustained, and further gains cannot be made if we lose our focus from those strategic choices that we have made, and now we know that they have delivered positive results.
Two of those strategic choices were investing in the health sector's human resources and making sure that the country maintains adequate supplies of necessary drugs. Failure on those fronts was the major undoing of Zimbabwe's health care over the past two decades. It was only after organizations such as the U.S. Agency for International Development and the European Union poured in money that the situation changed. Itai Rusike, who has the Community Working Group on Health, an organization fighting for all Zimbabweans to enjoy health care, expressed optimism about the UNICEF report.
Generally, I think this is a good report. It gives us hope in the sense that the indicators are kind of improving. But this report has to also be linked up to what is happening on the ground.
He said there's still a dire need for better water and sanitation in most parts of Zimbabwe. More than 30% of Zimbabweans still do not have access to safe drinking water, the research showed. Rusike says the real number is likely higher than that since most taps in urban areas are dry. Dr. Gerald Gwinji, a senior official at Zimbabwe's Ministry of Health, is more upbeat. He says the new health report gives the country a sense of direction.
We now need to work on issues of quality and equity. These survey results are going to be one of the pillars of our next national health strategy. And the next step is to do a bottleneck analysis for us as Minister of Health and Child Care. And this will help us determine where to focus further to improve on our health indicators.
Gwinji said Zimbabwe's maternal mortality rate, 614 deaths in every 100,000 pregnancies, and infant mortality rate of 75 per 100,000 are still too high. He says further investment can reduce those losses. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Methane gas from an Plodding Lake should soon become a major source of electricity thanks to business deals signed at the U.S.-Africa Summit in Washington early August. The deal between American company Symbion Power and the Rwandan government will not only provide power but reduce the risk of an environmental catastrophe in Lake Kivu, as Nick Long reports for VOA.
There are only three lakes in Africa known to have high enough levels of carbon dioxide and methane gas in the water to be at risk of exploding, and two of them, both in Cameroon, exploded in the 1980s. Carbon dioxide released from Lake Neos killed more than 1,700 people in villages up to 26 kilometres away. A gas eruption from the third body of water, Lake Kivu, could dwarf that disaster, as there are more than 2 million people living near its shores in large towns including Goma and Gisenyi. The methane is most at risk of erupting and needs to be extracted, says Paul Hinks, chief executive of energy company Symbion Power, which earlier in August signed a deal to install a 50-megawatt power station at Lake Kivu.
The build-up of methane in Lake Kivu is a serious problem for Rwanda. So what the plans have been for Lake Kivu is to turn methane gas into power. So you can take the safety problem and turn it into a positive thing, which is to provide electricity.
Some experts say there is a high risk that another eruption of Mount Nyiragongo, a volcano just outside Goma, could trigger a lake explosion at any time. Nyiragongo has erupted several times in the past, spilling lava into the lake in 2002. Scientists agree the methane level needs to be reduced, but have voiced concern that pumping the gas out could itself trigger a dangerous disturbance, as Paul Hinks acknowledges.
The problem is, of course, you just put in a pipe and you start sucking out the water and separating the methane and the CO2 from the water. There is the potential to create the very problem which you're trying to avoid, which is escape of the methane gases into the atmosphere.
He says specific safeguards have been agreed to, which will ensure that there is no leakage of methane or disturbance to the equilibrium of the lake.
There are sets of rules, if you like. They're called lake management prescriptions, and they cover all the issues that companies like us have to follow when they are extracting methane gas from the lake.
So far, the only significant user of the lake's methane is a 3-megawatt plant in Gisenyi, run by the Kibuye Power Company, formerly a joint venture with Scandinavian firm Dane Associates. Kibuye Power's plant manager, Laurent Sibomana, told VOA about some of the obstacles to methane gas extraction.
The difficulty we have, firstly, is a spare part. We don't have spare part in the local market. And another challenge we face there is weather. Sometimes we have a big wave in this lake.
In 2008, big waves sank a 3.6 megawatt platform that another company, the Rwandan Investment Group, had installed. Disputes over contracts have been another problem. US firm Contour Global's Lake Kivu project has been delayed by a dispute with a subcontractor, and Kibuye Power was reduced from a 40 megawatt to a 3 megawatt project after the Rwandan government cancelled its contract with Dane Associates. So up to now, extracting gas from Lake Kivu has not been a success story, says Hinks. But his company has specialised in working in difficult places, such as Iraq and Afghanistan, and as a founding partner in the US government's Power Africa initiative, he is confident Symbion Power has the solutions and the financing for this challenge. Meanwhile, in Gisenyi, phone card salesman Emmanuel Morambe says he has noticed the lake is so hot around the Kibuye power plant, one can cook food in it.
Some people, they visited that Kibuye power. Yeah, many people, they like to go there. Yeah, when you put the Irish potatoes, after 30 minutes, it will be already cooked.
He and his neighbours around Lake Kivu are looking forward to having more of that power at home and a safer environment. Nick Long for VOA News, Gisenyi.
Rebel groups from northern Mali have agreed to end hostilities and present a united front ahead of negotiations with the Malian government that begin in Algiers next week. Katarina Hoije in Bamako has more for VOA from that place.
With peace talks between the rebels and the Bamako government around the corner, representatives from two rebel groupings have signed an agreement to end fighting and work towards a sustainable solution for northern Mali. The agreement was signed Thursday in Burkina Faso's capital, Ouagadougou, where the rebel groups, including the National Movement for the Liberation of Azawad, the MNLA, the High Council for the Unity of Azawad, the HCUA, and the Arab Movement of Azawad, the MAA, have gathered before negotiations start on September 1st in Algiers. In recent months, clashes between the MNLA and the MAA have caused new displacements in the north. The agreement is a small but important step towards ending Mali's 18-month-long crisis. It started in 2012 with a Tuareg separatist rebellion and a military coup that fractured the country and led to Islamist extremists occupying Mali's north. 10 months later, the extremists were pushed out by international forces. Despite elections a year ago, violence continues in Mali's north, and talks are aimed at plotting a roadmap for reconciliation and unity. David Gressley, with the UN Stabilization Mission in Mali, the MINUSMA, says he thinks all parties realize they share a common interest in a comprehensive agreement.
It is absolutely essential to have an agreement in the north of Mali. If we want stability, a return of development, to remove the sense of isolation and marginalization that many in the north feel, even those who did not take arms in rebellion.
The first round of discussions were held in July in Algiers. At that time, representatives of six northern Mali armed groups, including the MNLA, the HUA, and also representatives of Sonsoray and Pearl militias, met with a government delegation led by Mali Foreign Minister Abdoulaye Diop. But the main challenge is reconciling the various agendas of rebel factions, says Professor Issan Diaye at the University of Bamako.
La solution dépend donc jusqu'où, par exemple, la France.
He says international pressure, especially from France, which still has troops in Mali, will be essential to get the groups to reach an agreement. The main issue on the agenda is the status of northern Mali, roughly two-thirds of the country's territory. While the separatist rebel groups have dropped claims for independence and opted for autonomy, it is still not clear what form it could take. The government has been very clear on how far it is willing to go.
Ceux qui sont pour un Mali et indivisible, laïque, républicain, prospère, les discussions se feront.
Prime Minister Moussa Mara says the goal is a political and social solution that all parties can agree to within the limits drawn by the government. Those limits mean that Mali will remain one inseparable country with a secular government and the continued presence of the Malian army and police throughout the territory. A definitive agreement would end 50 years of armed conflict sparked by decades of Tuareg separatist movements. Katarina Höje for VOA News in Bamako.
South Africa's flagship Kruger Park, home to the world's largest population of rhino, is on the front lines of a poaching war. The government has announced a plan to move up to 500 rhinos in an attempt to increase their population and counter a poaching epidemic that has seen hundreds of rhinos killed for their horns just this year. The relocation are just part of a multi-pronged approach to save the animals. But in the face of the lucrative illegal horn market, is it enough? Gillian Parker reports from Kruger.
Two rhinos graze on the tall grass in the lower Sabi region of Kruger National Park, unaware of their bloated cousin lying dead just a metre away. Vultures eye the body greedily from a nearby tree, while an orchestra of flies feast on the latest victim of poaching.
Standing up. It was still standing when they actually used the axe. Why?
An investigator from the South Africa National Parks Crime Unit gingerly steps around the butchered animal to collect evidence, in the hopes of catching the perpetrators. A metal detector locates the bullet inside the body before the team dissects the carcass. Poachers shot the rhino and broke its back with an axe to immobilise it, before gouging out its horns, the prize they hope to sell to Asians who view rhino horn as a status symbol or erroneously think it is a healing agent. Lawrence Baloy, a ranger of the Lower Sabi, knows how easy it is for young men to be coaxed into the hunt.
They're clever. If someone got a rhino, when he gets it, it's like a big boss, make a big party, you know, all the ladies, they rush to him. So he's sending information that, guys, you busy sitting here, we're making man there. Follow me next, you understand? So that's why those groups, they escalate every day.
South Africa has grappled with a wave of poaching, leaving nearly 700 rhinos killed since January, with 458 slaughtered in Kruger Park alone. The government plans to relocate up to 500 rhino to other state-owned and private parks. Nearby countries, Botswana and Zambia, might also be considered as safe havens. South Africa has relocated 1,450 animals from Kruger over the past 15 years to manage herd populations. The colossal operation involves tracking the animals in the rugged bush, darting them with tranquilizers from helicopters, and then moving them in customized trucks. Kruger's head vet, Dr. Marcus Hofmeyer, explains.
The whole success of rhino survival in Africa, at least, has pretty much been based on the fact that they were translocated to different areas. With the threat of poaching, we want to try and create opportunities where they can actually breed successfully and quickly so that we offset some of the poaching losses and in time maximise on growth.
Relocating rhinos might disperse the poachers' targets, but SANParks teams know it won't be enough to put off criminal networks behind the lucrative trade. Only 400 rangers have the task of patrolling the park's 2 million hectares. Bruce Leslie is part of the special operations team.
The poachers are, and the syndicates are driven to be successful because the reward is so great. The tactics of the poachers evolve incredibly fast, and so it's incumbent upon us to adapt as fast as they do.
In 2010, poachers could get $7,500 for a set of horns. But now they get much more, explains Cobus de Ved of the Crime Investigation Unit.
A lot of poachers were fatally wounded. The poachers also decided that now they don't want to be paid as a hunt itself. They want to be paid in kilogram, in weight.
A large horn can now fetch a maximum price of $120,000 by weight. Riches like these have attracted criminal networks operating from Southern Africa to China. So while relocating and protecting rhino might spread the risk or outfox a few poachers, experts say it will not be enough until international coordination follows the money trail and brings down the rhino horn kingpins. Gillian Parker for VOA News, Kruger Park.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, from the classroom to the real world, the Mandela Washington Fellows intern with some of America's top employers and government agencies. What did they learn? Find out next week, right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Kim Lewis.
And I'm Yehiyas Wuhib.
Together we host The Voice of America's informative program, Africa News Tonight.
We present a thorough summary of the day's events, featuring interviews with newsmakers in Africa and the world.
Also, Sunny Young drops in live with sports, and we have features on science, health, and business.
Tune in Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Sunday Shomari. Join me every Monday for your lighthearted show, Let's Talk. That's right, Monday at 17:30 UTC for interviews, great music, and a whole lot of laughter. Right here at the VOA Africa. Keep it locked, VOA Africa, don't miss.
I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, Please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America. This is The Voice of America, and you're listening to NetLine Africa. Coming up in the second half of the program, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital Lagos, and music from African Collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But right now, it's time for NetLine Africa Sports, and for that, let's go straight to Lagos and join Segun on the dot at DMA. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Douglas, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to NetLine Africa Sports for Sunday, August 31st. The fireworks are about to restart in the qualifying series for the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations to be hosted by Morocco next year. We'll get to that shortly, but first, the African Youth Championship qualifiers. Ivory Coast, Ghana and Zambia have qualified for the finals of the 2015 CAF Under-20 football tournament. TAJ, the African Youth Championship, slated for Senegal next year. The countries sealed their places in the finals with convincing wins on Saturday in their return leg final qualifying matches. They joined host and automatic qualifier Senegal and Nigeria, which qualified for the final tournament after Lesotho pulled out of their final qualifying over Ebola fears. The remaining three places will be decided today, Sunday, between South Africa and Cameroon, Togo and Mali, as well as Egypt and Congo. Ivory Coast bounced back from a 2-1 loss in the first leg to beat Libya 3-1 in Abidjan. In Libreville, Gabon was stunned by Ghana, which humbled its host 4-1 in front of its local fans. The Gabonese held the Black Satellites to a barren draw in the first leg in Accra 2 weeks ago, but they were outplayed by the Ghanaians, who sealed qualification in grand style. And Zambia completed a double over neighbor Malawi, winning 1-0 to go through 3-1 on aggregate. The final tournament is scheduled for March 8th to 22nd, 2015. The semi-finalists at the tournament will represent Africa at the FIFA Under-20 World Cup in New Zealand later next year. Back to the qualifying series for the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations, the Appeals Board of the Confederation of African Football, CAF, has upheld the decision of the organizing committee of the tournament, which disqualified Rwanda from the final phase of qualifying. Congo has therefore replaced Rwanda in the last phase of qualification for the tournament and will compete in Group A against Nigeria, South Africa and Sudan. According to the African football's governing body, the decision followed the appeals board hearing of August 27th in Cairo, Egypt, which upheld the decision of the organizing committee of the tournament on August 17th that disqualified Rwanda based on Article 41 of the Nations Cup regulations. The regulation states that any team that has committed fraud in the identity of a player for qualification and or involved a suspended player will lose the match and shall be eliminated from the competition. It was established that the player Dadi Birori, playing with the national team of Rwanda, was the same that played in the Champions League with AS Vita Football Club of the Democratic Republic of Congo, using the name Etekiama Ajiti Tadi. CAF said, based on available documents, it was evident that the Rwanda Federation was aware of this double identity, but proceeded all the same to feature the player for the national team. The last phase, which is the group stage of the 2015 Nations Cup qualifying, will begin across Africa next weekend. The winners and runners-up from each of the seven groups, plus the best third-place team, qualify for the finals. In a related development, CAF says it has not changed its position on the announced schedule of matches for match days 1 and 2 in the final qualifying for the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations in Morocco. Sierra Leone, Guinea and Liberia, which have been ravaged by Ebola, remain the only countries required to relocate their home matches to neutral venues, as indicated in the CAF circular to member countries on August 12, 2014. As earlier announced, CAF will reassess the situation in mid-September 2014 on whether or not to allow the affected countries to receive teams and organize CAF matches and competitions. The final phase of the 2015 Nations Cup qualifiers will start next weekend across Africa. The two matches are slated for September 10th. Now, 14 matches will be played next weekend, the weekend of September 5th to 7th, in the Nations Cup qualifying. That translates to two matches per each of the seven groups. Let's remind our listeners that 28 teams are playing in the group phase of the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations qualifying. They are divided into seven groups of four teams each. Each team will play six matches between September 5th and November 19th, after which the top two finishers in each group, plus the overall best third-place team, will advance to next year's finals. Let's now give a quick rundown of the opening fixtures, scheduled for next Friday and Saturday. Group A, Sudan hosts South Africa, while Congo travels to Nigeria. Group B, Ethiopia is at home to Algeria, just as Mali hosts Malawi. Group C, Burkina Faso hosts Lesotho, while Gabon hosts Angola. Group D, Democratic Republic of Congo is at home to Cameroon, while Sierra Leone travels to Ivory Coast. Group E, Togo plays Guinea at home, while Ghana hosts Uganda. Group F, Mozambique travels to Zambia, while Cape Verde goes to Niger. And Group G, Africa's most successful team at the Nations Cup and seven-time winner Egypt travels to Senegal, while Tunisia hosts Botswana. Staying with the 2015 Nations Cup qualifiers, a new challenge is awaiting Egypt. The Pharaohs, who have bagged seven titles, missed the last two editions of the continent's most prestigious football tournament after achieving an unprecedented feat by winning three titles in a row between 2006 and 2010. The Egyptians are now looking for a return to the African football showpiece under a new trainer. Egypt will kick off its Morocco 2015 qualifying campaign with a Group B doubleheader away to Senegal on September 5th before hosting Tunisia 5 days later in Cairo. New coach Shoki Garib will make his official debut as Pharaoh's mentor away to Senegal in Dakar. The former Egypt midfielder won the continental title as a player in 1986 on home soil before achieving the same feat as assistant to Hassan Shehata three times in a row, 2006, 2008, and 2010. Garib is also famous for guiding Egypt to his best achievement in the history of the FIFA Under-20 World Cup, a bronze medal in 2001 in Argentina. He took over the mantle last November from American Bob Bradley, who was shown the exit after losing to Ghana 7-3 on aggregate during the 2014 FIFA World Cup playoffs. To qualify for the 2015 AFCON, we have to start well, Garib told CAFOnline.com, the official website of African soccer's governing body. Our group is a tough one and we have to start on a positive note. We respect Senegal, Tunisia and Botswana the same way, but our target is to qualify for the final tournament in Morocco, he says. The 55-year-old has named 30 players, 12 of whom ply their trade abroad for camping. On Saturday, Egypt beat Kenya 1-0 in a preparatory friendly in Aswan. Finally, the Confederation of African Athletics has announced Africa's team to the 2014 IAAF Continental Cup to be held in Marrakech, Morocco, on September 13th and 14th. In the male category, the stars include 800 meters runners Nigel Amos of Botswana and Mohamed Aman of Ethiopia, 2014 IAAF World Indoor Championships 1500 meters gold medalist Ayanle Suleiman of Djibouti, 2013 World 1500 meters champion Asbel Kiprop of Kenya, as well as Egypt's Ihab Abdurrahman, who leads the 2014 World Javelin lists. In the female class, notable names include Nigeria's Blessing Okagbare and the Ethiopian distance trio of Genzeba Dibaba, Almaz Ayana, and Hiwot Ayaleo. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Douglas the Mighty Umpuga in Washington.
Thank you, Segun. Segun on the dot, Adeyemi will be back again next Sunday for another look at Africa Sports right here on Nightline Africa. Yes, it's Sunday here on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to listen to some music from the continent. So just sit back, relax, and enjoy. Yeah.
Karina, oh oh. Mburira vanga chendi choliko. Mburira tobanga wantegendo bo. Omukwana wechivanga chirwa de. Chino chiri kumutima. Wechivanga chiroto. Saga lanzu kusa. Ah, tulikuchi, tulikuchi, tulikuchi. Ah, alikuchi, alikuchi, alikuche yo. Niwe, 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 niwe. Niwe, 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 niwe. Nagu kunga vishwanzi. Nagu shaka vishwanzi. Nagu kunga vishwanzi. Nagu shaka vishwanzi. 1 2 1 2, babidi babidi, hey. Zenterete, sichono nyakwendi kontete. Ya kwari mubye njagala, osula kumutwenga vidi. Yebawe kagwe negomba, osuza kutebuche. Bakami nari nari na oh oh, yezari na oh oh. Bakami nari nari na oh oh, yezari na oh oh. Kulina, ooh baby, zagumana nawe, antin zakulina, ooh baby, saba choyo ya, uli choyo galanchirina, ooh, nawe cholina chene gombe wange, zachirina, nabonina, zakulina baby, zakulina, nabonina, zakulina baby, oh, oh, aye, bakari nari nari na, oh, oh, ye zari na, oh, oh. Bakami nari nari na oh oh, he is nari na oh oh. Bakami nari na, bakami nari na, bakami nari 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 na oh oh. Mawe, mawe, ya mawe, ya mawe. Nagu kunda vishwanzi, nagu shaka vishwanzi, nagu kunda vishwanzi, nagu shaka vishwanzi. Niwe, niwe.
Chinonchisenga ninawe, chokwogera kiba kitone. Olina engeri gy'oyunga ebigambo ebigendera kumera. Chinonchisenga ninawe, chokwogera kiba kirabo. Ndabira ku ngeri gy'onoza ebirowoozo gwe buli lw'oyogera. Abalala boogera lukunkumuli nga ne bwe boogera sitegeera. Naye kwoyogera kigambo kimu nintegeera.
Oli baluwa, baluwa ekyuto kugamba muwoma. Ebaluwa bwe nsoma mu nnyimba n'ebinyuma. Oli baluwa, baluwa ekyuto kugamba mambo. Ebaluwa bwe nsoma mu nnyimba n'ebinyuma.
balala babi tebamanyi na kwogera ne bwe boogera situkako bomanyi engeri kyukatta ebigambo ebintengule meme bali tebalina bye bagamba ne bwe boogera situkako gwali n'obugambo buwonu okuweweza sabasaba ng'enjuba ekyamulisa akamakote kagw'ebigambo saagala kusubwa bugambo bwo obuweweza
That was Irene Namobiru with that new tune. And that was a Sunday Music Spot. I hope you enjoyed that music. Coming to you right from here, from the English service of the Voice of America. Now, let's take a closer look at Africa. One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Here is Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Speaking in Victoria Falls last week as the recently designated chairman for 12 months of the Southern African Development Community, President Robert Mugabe, the 90-year-old president of Zimbabwe, cautioned his Southern African leaders at their two-day summit to avoid being over-reliance on foreign assistance. Although President Mugabe, the ever irrepressible and combative president, was speaking to SADC, his advice should be relevant to the entire African continent. The fact that the remarks were uttered by the Zimbabwean president does not make it less important. In fact, over the years, many African publicists, scholars have complained that African countries have overly relied on foreign assistance. What really incensed President Mugabe was the fact that 60% of SADC's budget was funded by foreign governments. He could have gone further, by noting that the continental headquarters of the African Union in Addis Ababa was built by the Chinese government. Much surprising also is the fact that the headquarters of the Peace and Security Commission was funded by the German government. It is satisfying that President Mugabe spoke about the generosity of donor governments. So his concern was not foreign assistance per se. He was more concerned with the overindulgence with foreign assistance. He also said to the delegates at the SADC summit that they could use the rich resources in Africa to rely less on foreign assistance. What can be so disconcerting is how easy and comfortable many African officials roll so quickly over their mouth the expression, "We will seek donor funding." Psychologists and sociologists have conducted very good research to indicate that dependency can trigger inferiority complex and tendency for governments not to take those receiving aid seriously. In fact, some have suggested that the current weakness of the African group in the United Nations could be found in the fact that too many African governments are depending on foreign assistance. One does not have to reject all foreign assistance. Europe itself, at the end of the Second World War, depended on the Marshall Plan, which was given generously by the government and people of the United States. But today, Europe is on its feet and prospering. Africa should, at this stage, begin to determine how best it could rely on its own resources. Few years ago, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton made a remarkable speech in East Africa when she noted that there is less trade between African countries and that an increase in case about 2 or 3% could be sufficient for African states to depend less on foreign assistance. So at this stage, people and governments of Africa should listen to the caution and advice of President Mugabe. The time has come for Africa to begin to wean itself from donor funding. It doesn't serve the purpose and future of the continent. I thank you.
That was an anchor commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Join us again next Saturday. I'm Douglas Impogam. Have a good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Less than 3 years ago, on October 23, 2011, Libyans celebrated the country's liberation from longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. A broad coalition of groups composed of people from all walks of life banded together, disregarding regional, religious, tribal, ethnic, and political differences, to rid the nation of a brutal regime. After months of fighting and the loss of too many lives, a bright new future finally seemed within reach of the people of Libya. Unfortunately, it would not be that easy. Rival groups that had united to defeat a common enemy soon turned on each other and began to fight in earnest to further their narrow agendas. Still, despite the upheaval, the country seemed to be moving forward, holding general elections in July 2012 and another one in June 2014 for a new House of Representatives that was seated in August. Since May, the three-year-long upward spiral of violence escalated. In Benghazi, assassinations and attacks on government forces continued in the wake of former Libyan National Army commander Khalifa Haftar's attacks on Islamic extremists, which he then declared part of a broader campaign against all Islamists in Libya, whom he likened to flesh-eating microbes in a May 20th interview. In mid-July, rival militias began a battle for control of Tripoli International Airport. After 5 weeks of fighting, hundreds of deaths, and millions of dollars worth of damage to Libya's infrastructure, the Operation Dawn affiliates gained control of the airport. These Operation Dawn affiliates then proceeded to declare a new government, a move denounced by the country's official government. And the fighting continues. In a joint statement, the governments of the United States, France, Germany, Britain, and Italy strongly condemned the escalation of fighting and violence in and around Tripoli, Benghazi, and across Libya. The five countries called on all parties in Libya, including the government and all militias, to accept an immediate ceasefire, engage constructively in the democratic process, and to stop all activities that risk undermining it. "We support the efforts of the UN support mission in Libya in this regard," said the statement. "We call on Libya's interim government and the elected House of Representatives to adopt inclusive policies that benefit all Libyans and to build a government that meets the Libyan people's needs for security, reconciliation, and prosperity. We encourage the Constitutional Drafting Assembly to immediately pursue the drafting of a document that enshrines and protects the rights of all Libyans. Further, we encourage the international community to support Libya's elected institutions."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.